Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
Driverless cars sound pretty cool, but do they have our best interest in their computer minds?
It's an object that has the power to kill people.
And if my car has to make a choice, kill me or kill somebody else, who will it pick?
I'm sorry, Dave.
I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. On today's show, stopping to smell the roses when your nose is no longer working, sticking your arm into a tank filled with hungry mosquitoes for science, and tracking the urge to curse deep in our brains. But first up, Uber launched its pilot program of driverless cars in Pittsburgh recently. Pittsburgh has become the hub for this technology. And to create a proper buzz around the launch, Uber invited a couple of journalists to go on ride-alongs. That proved to be a stellar PR move. We heard all about this.
The future is now.
The inside of a self-driving Uber is different.
We're standing next to one right here in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
This feels completely normal, the whole thing from calling it, sitting back here. I would have no idea that this car was driving itself.
The turn signal came on automatically, and now it's turning itself.
One of the reporters invited was Liz Reed from our partner station WESA in Pittsburgh. Here she is getting into her driverless Uber.
So I'm going to click on this button that says Let's Ride to get started on the iPad. And it's asking me if my seatbelt is fastened. Two-rider maximum, no destination changes. We are all set. So I'm going to push all set. Here we go, it says.
Liz wasn't in this car all by herself. There were two co-pilots sitting up front, making sure that everything went off without a hitch. And Liz is here now to debrief a little bit about her ride. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Maiken.
I listened to a lot of the news coverage, and it felt like, I don't know what I expected, but it felt a little bit less exciting than perhaps what I had hoped for.
I would say that's an accurate statement. And I would say I identify with that as well. At first, you know, I was really excited about this. They had lined up these 14 cars outside the Uber offices, and they've all got these futuristic looking sensory devices mounted on the roof. And they told us beforehand, you know, there's 64 channels of lasers collecting 1.4 million distance measurements every second. So it's like, wow, that's amazing. And they have all these cameras on them. It felt very much like a one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind kind of moment. But then we got in the car, and there was this iPad welcoming us by name and then showing us a rendering of our surroundings, which was pretty cool. But then the sheen sort of started to fall away shortly after our ride in the car actually began. And it became clear that this technology is still a long, long way from really changing the way we move around cities.
What do you mean? What didn't work for you?
Well, you know, Uber and other self-driving car makers, they have to err on the side of safety, which makes sense. But what does that mean when you're trying to program safety into a computer? So here's an example. We were coming up on a car that was parallel parking, and though there was room to change lanes and go around it, our car stayed put and just waited. You know, that's fine. It didn't really waste too much time, but it's probably not what most human drivers would have done. Most people would have gone around the car because there were no other vehicles approaching in that lane. And what's really interesting, it looks like other reporters had the same experience, but just a little bit different. And my favorite one that I've read is from Nathan Ingram of Engadget. His car came to a four-way stop, and because it's programmed to drive as safely as possible, it was waiting for the other cars that were going in different directions to come to a full and complete stop before it would move. And maybe this is just a Pittsburgh thing, but very few drivers actually fully stop at a stop sign. You know, they just kind of slowly might roll through it. And so because of that, the Uber car didn't move. Though it had the right-of-way several times, it didn't move. And so basically, the human driver had to take over in order to get the car to continue on its way.
So it sounds like Uber needs to program in a little bit less of my grandmother and a little bit more of my Uncle Klaus, who always had a sports car and was just like honking at everybody and swerving and going.
Yeah, I mean, you can imagine, you know, this is during midday and this is a very benign situation when traffic was very light. When you extrapolate that to rush hour, it's easy to imagine the Uber car just being completely paralyzed in a city like Pittsburgh, let alone New York City or LA, where the traffic gets really crazy. You know, sometimes human drivers have to make these risky moves to get where they're going. There's a lot of instantaneous risk-reward calculations we're making, and it really remains to be seen whether autonomous vehicles will be able to do that.
Liz, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mikan.
Liz Reed is a reporter with WESA in Pittsburgh, and while you don't want a driverless car to be ridiculously timid, safety is obviously front and center here. Most deadly car crashes are caused by human error, so it means there's potential to save lives here, but these driverless cars have to do better than us. Federal regulators just released a 15-point safety checklist for driverless cars. Here are a couple of examples of what's outlined. The cars have to be able to switch safely from autopilot to human driver. They have to be able to avoid sudden problems, such as a falling tree, and they have to obey the speed limits across state lines. But there's also a line item on ethical questions, asking car makers to be transparent about how the vehicle will respond in a no-win situation. Somebody's going to die, but who? This brings us to something known as the trolley problem.
What philosophers call a thought experiment. My first name is Iyad, and surname is Rahwan. I'm an associate professor at the MIT Media Lab.
The trolley problem goes like this. A runaway trolley is speeding along, and its brakes are not working.
And it's moving unstoppable on a train track.
The trolley is about to kill five people.
Who are, for some reason or another, stuck on the track. Maybe there are five workmen fixing the track and they don't have enough time to move off the track.
But there is another track the trolley could move onto. There, it would kill one worker.
And you are in control of a lever that you can pull in order to move the trolley to the second track.
Would you pull that lever and kill one worker and save five lives, or do nothing and kill five? Iyad Rahwan says, broadly speaking, two schools of philosophical thought guide the response. One is utilitarianism.
Which means I should take the action that will produce the best outcome. And in this case, the best outcome is to kill fewer people, so I should pull the lever.
On the other side is duty-based or deontic ethics.
We should not do something that is fundamentally wrong. So the action itself of killing a person through performing an act is intrinsically wrong, regardless of the outcome. And therefore, those people will just receive their fate. And a human being is wrong to take an action that will alter that.
Rahwan works at MIT, and he is one of the people who is really trying to get everybody involved in these ethical issues around this new technology.
It is possible for a scenario to happen in which a driverless car may run over people because it fails to stop. And it's also conceivable that the car may take a different course of action in this situation. Now, the fundamental difference is that now it is not a human being with ethical intuitions who is making these decisions, but rather it's a computer program. It's an algorithm that is designed and built by people, but that is acting autonomously in the real world in that moment.
But do we as humans do any kind of ethical analysis before making a decision in a situation where we might crash into a wall, killing ourselves, or we might crash into a crowd of people?
That's a very good question. So obviously, humans do not make any sort of explicit, conscious ethical analysis in these scenarios. What happens mostly is people freak out, they freeze, and they do an action that is random, that is driven by their gut feeling or their fear or their self-preservation instinct. Now, the difference here is that for the first time in the history of automotives, we're able to make that decision prior to that moment. So, in a way, you now have a moral imperative to make the right choice.
So Rahwan and his colleagues have created a website. It's called Moral Machine. And when you go on, you can go through a couple of different scenarios and you have to make choices. There are side-by-side images of a car about to get into an accident. Simple images looks a little bit like in a driver's manual from the DMV when you were first getting your permit. So the car could be programmed to go straight, that would mean killing pedestrians, or the car could be programmed to swerve off, hit a barricade, and kill the people in the car. That would include you. So you have to click on one or the other, and then the scenarios keep changing up. Sometimes there are more people in the car, sometimes fewer. The pedestrians are older, younger. They are bank robbers or doctors, so it gets really hairy.
We wanted people to confront the difficulty of making those types of moral decisions and to appreciate the complexity of those types of trade-offs that regulators and lawmakers have to make. If society does not want those cars to discriminate based on gender or age, for example, then society needs a way to articulate those expectations, and we need to ensure that they are implemented.
How do you think all of this will enter the production of these vehicles? I mean, ultimately, as a customer, don't I want a vehicle that will prioritize me?
Of course. So in our study, the first thing we found was that people, by and large, wanted cars to be utilitarian. So they wanted the cars to minimize total harm, regardless of whether it was sacrificing the passerby that the car would swerve towards, or whether the car would sacrifice the passenger in the car. But the catch is that when we asked people whether they would purchase such cars, they all said absolutely not. And this is not really surprising. People have a self-preservation instinct. So I think it's not about what the car should do in scenario A or scenario B, but it's about the how society as a whole can come to an agreement about what matters to us more and how we can enforce this agreement. So if everybody wants cars that, in aggregate, minimize the death toll, minimize the total harm from accidents in general, we need a way to enforce that. So I need a way to make sure that if I purchase a car that may, in a very unlikely scenario, may sacrifice me, I need to make sure that I'm not the only one doing that and that everybody else is buying into this social contract. Without regulation, we will definitely not get there. The public needs to understand that there are trade-offs. The public needs to buy into this and needs to believe that the regulators are implementing the public's wishes.
Can you think of a time in history where we faced a similar decision or maybe even something smaller?
Well, maybe this is taking it a little too far, but the analogy that I like to make is with the birth of the social contract, which is the foundation of modern democracy. In the 1600s, an English philosopher called Thomas Hobbes has basically laid the foundation of the social contract by saying that essentially government is an agreement between the public, between the people, to give certain powers to a central entity, and this government would basically enact the will of the people and help them get along, so enforce property rights, the rule of law, and so on. But what happens is then, at the same time, the people need to have checks and balances on this power. And I think what's happening now is, at the core, similar, but also fundamentally different, in that people are now giving powers to algorithms, and these powers have consequences on everyone, and we similarly need ways to keep checks and balances on those powers. And we are just beginning to learn how to do that, because When the government or the regulation is made up of people, we know how to deal with people. We don't really know how to do this with machines yet.
Iyad, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Iyad Rahwan is a professor at the MIT Media Lab and one of the developers of the website Moral Machine. This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Imagine you wake up one day and suddenly you can't smell anything. Nothing. No coffee, no flowers, no chocolate chip cookies baking in the oven. And this isn't a stuffy nose. This is like a switch in your brain has been flipped. About 200,000 people go to the doctor for loss of smell each year. Sometimes steroids help or nasal sprays, surgery can be an option. But for many patients, this condition lasts for months or even years. Pulse reporter Todd Bookman caught wind of a new technique that relies on the brain relearning how to smell.
My name is Chris Kelly, and I am a person who lost their sense of smell after a virus. I'm called an anosmic.
Straight-backed and tall, Kelly, who was born in Maine and now lives in the UK, lost her ability to smell in 2012. She caught a cold, it moved into her sinuses, and then she woke up and it was just gone.
I opened my eyes, I went into the bathroom, I uncapped the toothpaste, and was immediately aware that I couldn't smell anything.
Colds and other viruses are a common cause of anosmia, but it can also be brought on by a brain injury or from nasal polyps. Aging is another factor. Different parts of the olfactory system, the receptors, or the nerve simply stop working. And as quickly as it's lost, some people will spontaneously recover their ability to smell. But not Chris Kelly. She sought medical treatment, tried steroids, still nothing.
The most poignant loss for me was the loss of the smell of my children. And, you know, my children are grown now, but when I put my arms around them, I could easily recognize their smell.
Kelly says it was like every facet of her life lost a dimension. Today, though, much of her ability to smell is restored.
Can you hear me now?
Yes,
good.
Sir.
Right. Well, thank you very much.
Kelly is here at the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia, where she's leading a workshop in something called smell training. She's not a doctor, but she is an evangelist for this type of anosmia treatment.
It started out as this thing that was a chore, like flossing my teeth, and it's ended as a kind of an altered awareness.
The smell training concept is simple. Even if you can't smell anything, anosmics need to keep trying and do so in a mindful way. Spend a few minutes in the morning, again in the evening, sniffing deeply. The repeated exposure and concentration may eventually yield results, but don't expect overnight success. It can take months, even longer.
I'm not getting anything out of lavender at all. Could you smell lavender?
Mary Beth James lost her ability to smell after being hit by a car. She's here at the workshop because it's been 4 years, with very few gains made.
Lavender is a no. I'm not getting that one.
Scattered in front of Mary Beth and all the other attendees are vials of essential oils, potent little jars of concentrated lavender, as well as rose, eucalyptus, lemon, and clove. There are no hard rules for what you should smell, but those are the scents recommended by Thomas Hummel, a German ear, nose, and throat doctor and a guru of modern smell training. He's published studies showing it can work, especially for anosmics who start soon after the injury. That hope has Kenneth Lee digging his nose deep into the rose oil, dreaming of just a whiff.
You know, if you go to garden, I like gardening, but you don't smell any flowers, so...
Lee is just the saddest gardener in the world. And since flavor and smell are so closely linked, he's also lost the pleasure of eating. For many anosmics, everything tastes rubbery and beige. Edmund Probitkin is an ENT doc at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital, where he prescribes smell training to his patients. He says the condition can be devastating.
Smell affects so much of what we experience. It is such a potent sense. It really adds so much joy to life, and to lose it is really difficult. Folks become depressed. Folks have all kinds of problems.
So has everyone taken a break that wanted to? Anyone want to air out their nose by going outside? No.
Exactly how smell training can refresh the sense of smell isn't totally understood. But as Chris Kelly works the room, she tells people to treat it like they would physical therapy after an injury or a stroke. With no other options, Mary Beth James is willing to give the little vials of scented oil a chance.
You know, I want to be able to smell the turkey on Thanksgiving and the bread that I bake and the Christmas tree. So that's I'm giving it a shot. Why not?
Why not? She says even a bad aroma would be better than none at all. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Let's move up from our noses to our eyes. We often call the eyes the window to the soul. During a big performance arts festival in Philadelphia, it's called the Fringe Festival, two artists took a closer look into that statement. They explored if the simple act of gazing into each other's eyes could accelerate feelings of closeness and intimacy between people. They didn't need much, just some piping, a sheet, a stopwatch, and strangers. Strangers willing to participate in this experiment. Alana Gordon went to check it out.
Danielle Gatto and Makoto Hirano want to be clear about something.
We're not scientists.
We're not scientists.
They're theater artists, but
we're inspired by science and we want to create a space for people to be able to connect.
That inspiration came about a year ago, thanks to reading this really popular New York Times column and recently turned podcast, Modern Love.
Stories of love, loss, and redemption.
One of their most popular stories was about accelerating intimacy between people who don't know each other.
We walked to the highest point, then turned to face each other. I fumbled with my phone as I set the timer.
And one of the things the two characters in the story did, drawing from psychology experiments, was stare into each other's eyes silently for 4 minutes. This idea of mutual gazing really struck a chord with Hirano and Gatto. Could it build connections between strangers?
You can't just do this in your normal life. You can't just sit there and stare at someone for 4 minutes in your normal life, especially a stranger. That would be crazy.
Enter the 4-minute booth. The two recently set up the installation in an outdoor beer garden under an almost full moon by Philadelphia's iconic Ben Franklin Bridge.
You guys are interested in the booth?
Yeah.
Cool, great.
The idea is simple. Invite strangers to sit across from one another and look into each other's eyes, silently, without interruption, for 4 minutes. Hold up. Gatto and Hirano stress that this booth is not meant to be a romantic prompt. They're not looking to make strangers fall in love. They just want to try and facilitate positive connections between people. That's better.
What's your name?
Heather.
Heather is someone who doesn't know Heather.
Some people come over by chance. Others, like Kathy Huang and Tim Wilson, show up together on purpose.
A little excited, nervous.
I feel like 4 minutes is a long time.
I don't think I've held eye contact with anyone for that long.
And the only rule
Gatto looks for two people who don't know each other to take part. And at one point, she turns to me.
So you're gonna do it, right?
Oh, God. I guess I have to, don't I?
You have to.
Yeah.
It's only 4 minutes.
Ah!
And it's nothing to be scared of.
Before I know it, Gatto introduces me to someone I've never met before. I have no idea who or what this person is about.
We're going on opposite sides. There's two chairs in there.
Gatto has us briefly introduce ourselves, say where we're from, what we've been excited about recently. Basically, unimportant chit-chat to ease what could possibly be the most awkward thing either of us have ever done. We exchange a few brief glances. Gatto guides us to the booth, which really is just some white curtains neatly draped over a rectangular plastic pipe frame. And then white Christmas lights are on the top, which give it a soft, gentle glow.
And then we'll let you know when your 4 minutes are up, and you can exit the booth whenever you're ready.
We go in and sit across from each other, a few feet away. There's a little divider between us that goes up to about our knees. We settle in, and then it begins. I'm a little stiff, nervous, our eyes connect, and then I feel like everything is okay. I feel a sense of relief. Psychologists might call this an unconscious establishment of a safe relationship. Mother Nature has spent a lot of time and care creating these magic portals that are our eyes. Scientists have been well aware of their power for ages. Eyes are like the screen of an iPhone, as one researcher described to me, with a huge amount of stuff, of data processing going on behind that curtain, that screen of consciousness. A momentary flash of eye contact, let alone for 4 minutes, can reveal a lot. The person I'm facing is probably in his 50s. His long, flowing blonde hair, a delicate face. I notice it has subtle, sharp contours, too, which I'm sure have stories to tell. I'm curious. Back to the eyes. Perhaps the answers are in there. An extended mutual gaze is not a positive experience for everyone. An early trauma event or psychological condition can affect this. A gaze can convey a perceived threat. But one psychiatrist I talked to said under the right circumstances, an extended gaze can potentially help someone feel positively received and accepted, unconditionally. The eyes send safety signals to the brain. That can create a unique bond and even release oxytocin, which is sometimes called the cuddle hormone because it makes us feel safe and loved. Back in the booth, maybe the first minute has passed, I think about how I'm looking at this person. My movements are minimal, almost locked. Are they comfortable with this? How can I make the space more comfortable? Do I seem awkward? I become aware for a moment that this person is looking at me. Another 30 seconds, minute or so passes by. I start thinking, am I going to write about this experience? Shh, stop that. Just be in the moment. Wait, but will I have anything interesting to say? Mind, stop racing. Focus on their eyes. Okay, there they are. He reminds me of a dear friend of mine. I find comfort in that. Calmness. Wait, what? We were deep in our gaze, but he just looked away. What's going on? What happened? What do I do? I look away for a moment and pretend to brush something off my face. Some other experiments have found that averted eye contact in other scenarios can potentially lead to feelings of rejection, even isolation. Later, I find out he was moving a hair that was bothering him. Back to our eyes. They meet again. Time has become hard to gauge. For a moment, his face goes in and out of focus. His features soften. His eyes become one.
Your 4 minutes are up. You can exit the booth whenever you're ready.
Whoa, that was really, really fast. Suddenly, the noise of the city floods back in. Outside, people are talking with friends they know, others with the stranger they held eye contact with in that booth. We sit down to talk at a bench.
It was very interesting. My first initial reaction was to try to win the staring contest, but I recognized that right away and kind of dropped that. And I mean, I actually found it a very pleasurable experience, but thoughts were just kind of rushing through my head because it was almost like alone time while looking at you.
Yeah, I get that. We analyze other details, how he noticed that my left eye seemed bigger than my right eye. We talk about our lives, too.
I used to be a lawyer.
And suddenly, this person who I'd never met until like 10 minutes ago is no longer a stranger to me. I know if I see him again, we'll look at each other. Maybe a little longer than that typical momentary glance and smile. I meet back up with Daniel Gatto. She hovers near the booth with her stopwatch, keeping tabs on another group.
Your 4 minutes is up. You can exit the booth whenever you're ready.
And it appears that others are having positive experiences, too.
So the 4 minutes are up, but they're not leaving.
Oh, I just heard someone say, me too, and then they both started laughing.
For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. What do you say when you stub your toe really badly? Chances are it starts with an F, it has four letters, and it rhymes with truck. But you also might use that word when you want to emphasize how spicy your lunch was, or to express surprise, fear, joy. We curse to convey emotion and to evoke emotions in others. A new book called What the F? What Swearing Reveals About Our Language, Our Brains, and Ourselves digs deep into the brain science of cursing. The author, Ben Bergen, is a professor of cognitive science at the University of California, San Diego. I asked him, what happens in our bodies and our brains when we hear cursing?
Well, we know that profanity systematically has relatively reliable effects on human physiology. So hearing or reading a swear word in your native language, not necessarily as much in a foreign language, leads to an increase in heart rate, increase in blood pressure, pupil dilation, sweating of the palms, a whole host of physiological reactions that are all part of this evolutionarily old fight-or-flight reflex. And that seems to be the case whether the profanity is used by a comedian who's working blue or by an angry driver next to you who is frustrated about the way that you're using your vehicle.
So even me joking with a coworker, dropping the F-bomb for effect, could have that effect?
That physiological reaction happens either way. What's interesting is that that physiological reaction happens in lots of different circumstances, and what emotion we take that as indexing really depends on context.
And how does profanity affect our ability to process what is being said? Because basically it's just extra words. So does it hinder our ability to understand the meaning of what is being said or help it?
As you're saying, profanity oftentimes adds more information, not about the details of the scenario being described, doesn't provide factual information so much as it provides information about affect, information about what the speaker is feeling right now or what the speaker wants you to feel right now. But we definitely know that language with profanity in it is more memorable to the people who hear it and creates a sort of a flashbulb memory type of effect where people remember not just what was said, but the details of how it was said.
What do we know about swear words and evolution? I mean, it seems like humans have always cursed, but is there any thinking on the evolutionary functions of this or when we started doing this?
There's some amazing neuroscience on this. When people have brain damage to the parts of their brain that control the type of language that we're using right now, so articulating thoughts rationally, coherently, when people have damage to those parts of the brain, their language shuts down. This is known as aphasia, and there are about 1 million Americans today who suffer from one type of aphasia or another because of stroke or traumatic brain injury. Now, nevertheless, when these people suffer that sort of brain damage, they preserve the ability to swear spontaneously, and many of them often do. We've come to learn that the reason that you can get this dissociation where all of language can be damaged except for spontaneous swearing, that the reason for this is that spontaneous swearing is actually generated by a different part of the brain. It's not on the surface of the cortex like all of the other or many of the other abstract, evolutionarily modern things that smart humans can do. It's generated by a system known as the limbic system, in particular the basal ganglia, that's nested deep inside the middle of the brain that we share with other primates, other mammals, even other vertebrates, and that's responsible in other animals for shrieks and cries that are meant to express strong emotions, warning signals, signaling aggression, and so on.
Most of us curb our cursing around children. There was recently a popular joke kids book. It was called, I think, Go the F to Sleep. And I think the reason people thought it was so funny was because obviously you would never read that to your children. Why do we protect our children from offensive language? And what do we know about how it affects them?
This is a question that affects me very personally because I have a 2.5-year-old at home. And I've been very carefully looking through the scientific literature on profanity in children, whether it causes them harm, and if so, how. Here's basically what I've drawn from it. There are some strong words that seem to cause harm. And so those are specifically slurs. So when a child hears slurs, is called by slurs, that affects their emotional and cognitive development in negative ways. But when it comes to the rest of profanity, those fleeting expletives because you stepped on a piece of Lego or you tripped over a baby gate, those profanities have no demonstrable harm on children. So I think the reason that we think that they might is probably because of how we ourselves were raised when we were children. We were told these are bad words. Maybe we were punished for using them. And we've internalized those lessons. We just assume that, well, these words are bad. They could hurt kids. But as I've said, there's really no science pointing in that direction.
Plus, you probably don't want your toddler walking around cursing like a sailor, right?
Sure. I think that's a motivation for a lot of parents. But then the question becomes, well, what's the best way to teach your kids to use language carefully? And you have a couple of options. You can be a linguistic libertarian and take a big step back and say, well, whatever you want to do is fine. You can try to censor them, punish them when they use the words. Or you can model the behavior that you want them to display. So if you believe that they shouldn't be swearing in public, then you don't swear in public. They're learning that there are some behaviors that go in some places and not others.
So now, having written this book, when you curse, do you constantly evaluate your cursing based on your research?
Well, I definitely curse less when I'm talking about the book because, you know, I'm doing science. I want to talk about it objectively and so on. And I feel that using profanity in that context might actually detract a little bit from the message that I'm trying to convey. So I found that I've actually been swearing less as a function of this book, if you can believe it.
Ben, thank you so much for talking with me.
Well, it's been a lot of fun.
Ben Bergen has written What the F, What Swearing Reveals About Our Language, Our Brains, and Ourselves. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott. The global Zika virus epidemic has sent public health researchers searching for ways to combat the Aedes aegypti mosquito. This mosquito is the key culprit in the spread of Zika and a couple of other deadly diseases. Reporter Carrie Barber went to a lab in Miami where she met a researcher who thinks he might have found this mosquito's weakness.
Matthew DeGennaro, a neurogeneticist at Florida International University, is friendly and welcoming when I visit him in his lab on a late summer morning. He looks like a slightly hipper version of your high school science teacher in a short-sleeved plaid button-down, ready to patiently explain complex concepts. DeGennaro's lab doesn't look especially high-tech. With metal shelving and neatly labeled plastic tubs, it could be a bread baker's simple pantry, but looks can deceive. DeGennaro and his team are using advanced technology to cook up tools to do battle with the Aedes aegypti mosquito, the primary carrier of Zika, as well as dengue and yellow fever, and a particularly nasty virus called chikungunya.
So worldwide, approximately 725,000 people die every year because of mosquito-borne illness.
DeGennaro and his crew aren't the only team working on this problem. In fact, humans have tried for a century to exterminate Aedes aegypti with no success. But this group thinks they've found an Achilles heel of sorts in the pest that they hope to exploit.
Mosquitoes are born with the knowledge of how to find a human host. The primary way that mosquitoes find people is using their sense of smell.
The bacteria on our skin metabolizes our sweat and produces an odor that appeals mightily to the females, the only ones that bite. DeGennaro says, think of it this way. If you're a big meat eater and you haven't eaten for a few days, then someone serves you up a delicious-smelling, perfectly cooked roast beef. And DeGennaro's team is trying to create mosquitoes that simply can't smell us. If they can't find us, they can't nourish their eggs and reproduce. nor can they spread disease to us. His team has a powerful tool at its disposal, a gene editing technique called clustered, regularly interspaced, short, palindromic repeats. Did you get that? We'll call it CRISPR for short.
So it's an RNA-guided way of specifically going into the genome, taking a nuclease, and it just cleaves the gene just at one spot and just the gene that you're interested in. So this is an amazing technique that has sort of revolutionized biology in all sorts of ways.
It takes about 6 months to create a batch of modified mosquitoes, and then it's testing time. To see whether it's working, a tester puts his arm in a box behind a screen, and other team members send in the mutants. The ones that are attracted bang up against the screen, trying to get to the arm. In this way, researchers can tell whether they have genetically affected the insect's sense of smell.
We are getting closer. You know, I think we're making progress, so I'm hopeful that we can use this knowledge to really deeply understand how mosquitoes smell the world, and particularly how they smell people.
The team is also using the results of their genetics experimentation on the Aedes aegypti to develop attractants and repellents to control mosquito behavior.
You can actually make a repellent by trying to make our cells invisible to them, by blocking their sense of smell with a designer perfume. We and others hope to identify such chemicals and use them to hide people from mosquitoes.
Another group using genetics to approach the Aedes aegypti problem is the British company Oxitec. They're modifying male mosquitoes so that when they mate with females, their offspring will die almost immediately. The company's plans to test these mutants on a small island near Key West have become fodder for intense public debate. A referendum on whether they may release them in the wild will appear on the November 8th ballot. Until then, DiGennaro's lab will continue to focus on smell. And the stakes are high.
This is not about making like a redder tomato. This is about blocking a disease that is making it less safe for women to have children in Miami and across the world.
For The Pulse, I'm Carrie Barber.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mikan Scott. In 2008, composer and musician Daniel Fishkin noticed a ringing in his ears, and it never went away. He says doctors offered no solace besides, you'll get used to it. Eventually, Fishkin decided to incorporate his condition into his music. His new concert series and sound installation is called Composing the Tinnitus Suites 2016. The music is generated by a system of 20-foot-long piano wires activated by feedback. Fishkin told us about his composition and his condition for our series Patient Files.
I had some pretty profound experiences in 2008 when my ears first started ringing. The first night I had tinnitus, I was turning off the power of every appliance in the house that I was living in just to hopefully I would be able to flip a switch and turn off the sound that I was hearing. When I first had tinnitus, I was so petrified of loud sounds everywhere because I thought they were the enemy. So I would wear foam earplugs all the time. So you'd put in the foam earplugs to protect your ears and you hear the thing you're afraid of, the tinnitus. I was searching for, you know, tinnitus stories, and I read about this sheriff that just committed suicide because of his tinnitus, and he specifically said in his suicide note, you know, that he hoped his death could bring awareness to the condition. I was really moved because it was like everything I was doing in my life was not dealing with this problem of the tinnitus. I can't tell you how many times I tried that to like sit down with a band and continue to play music. I turned to circuit design and sound sculpture as a way of doing something in music that wasn't painful. I want to create a situation where my frame of listening doesn't have to be subsumed by the background, but where it can be dwelled upon, where it can direct the music. There would be times where I would listen and it seemed like I could control the sound. Like floating in and out of a dream state, the ringing would change in different intensities. Maybe the one thing I could be good at if my ears are messed up is listening to the way they're messed up. We tend to think about damage to the ear as absence. Oh, someday you won't be able to hear something, rather than there are all these other things that are associated with the hearing system that can go wrong. I mean, balance is a big part of them. You know, our ears are organs of hearing and balance. And I've heard the microphone metaphor, which is if you turn up the gain of something, eventually you begin to hear the noise floor in the system, and that's what tinnitus is. But where's the microphone? Where's the amplifier? So I think we're trying to make sense of something that defies some understanding. Pressing on my tinnitus every time I make music. I could interfere with it. I could infuriate my tinnitus. My tinnitus could get worse and yell at me. If you're hearing your tinnitus, you want to have a positive association with it. You don't want to hear it like this terrible, you know, demon. You want to hear it like an old friend. Now that I'm doing a project about tinnitus, when I hear my tinnitus, it's like, ah, there it is again.
Jonathan Pfeffer produced this piece. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, and Irina Zhorov. This week, we have to say goodbye to Todd Bookman, who is leaving us to go back to the state he loves the most, New Hampshire. We will miss Todd's adventures, his wit, and the kind of lines he always worked into his stories that we started calling the Bookman Zinger.
It actually has some poop.
We've got
20 volts.
That's not bad.
Having poop is apparently engineering speak for power. I didn't ask.
Good luck, Todd. Get that boat and send us your dispatches from the Granite State. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Paige Flager, our associate producer, Joel Patterson, the managing editor, and Megan Pinto, our executive producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. Next week on The Pulse.
I'm just hoping that Frankie doesn't feel left out because Max... I pretty much call Max the king of the house.
Ah, sibling rivalry. But Frankie and Max, they are pugs, dogs. Do animals really have the rich emotional lives that some people give them credit for?
I think at the end of the day, people perceive the mind they want to perceive.
Our animals and our brains. Don't miss that episode of The Pulse. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.